Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I am reading from True West Magazine, April 2022 edition. Wagons Ho, by True West Editors. True West's historians reveal the real history behind Taylor Sheridan's 1883. Hollywood producers, directors, and writers have often attempted to recreate the grandiosity and pageantry of an epic period in history on the silver screen and television. From John Ford to Raoul Walsh, from Cecil B. DeMille to John Wilder, Hollywood's most visionary mythmakers have entertained us all with big production as historically accurate as possible, sweeping ensemble westerns. From The Iron Horse, The Big Trail, Arizona, The Searchers, Bend in the River, How the West Was Won, and McCabe and Mrs. Miller, to I Will Fight No More Forever, Centennial, The Sacketts, Lonesome Dove, and Tombstone, producers have attempted to portray the West as realistically as possible. Enter writer, director, producer, and actor Taylor Sheridan. Until his recent success with Paramount's award-winning series Yellowstone, the award-winning actor was best known for his critically acclaimed screenplays, Cesario, Wind River, which he also directed, and Hell or High Water. With the critical and popular success of Yellowstone in the ever-expanding streaming marketplace, Sheridan realized the opportunity he had before him to create and produce a set of series telling the incredible backstory of Yellowstone's fictional Dutton family. Throw in the facts that Sheridan is a proud Texan, a great admirer and student of the Western genre, especially the high production value of Lonesome Dove, and you have the recipe for the creation of the Yellowstone origin story prequel, 1883. The largest and most expensive Old West television series ever produced. At True West, we admire Sheridan's ability to convince the studio and investors to help finance his production, which he has attempted to make as accurate as possible with the best creative team behind the creation of every wagon, costume, saddle, firearm, and prop. Always remembering it is Hollywood entertainment, not a documentary, we want to offer our readers an insightful look, through our historians, into the real history that inspired Sheridan's remarkable and entertaining Western series. And as we all are fans of 1883 and the genre, we are hopeful that more studio executives will have the courage to greenlight more Western series and films and rejuvenate this grand American art form. A snapshot of the West and America in 1883. If you were an immigrant who stepped off a passenger ship in New York, New Orleans, or Galveston with a train ticket to the West in 1883, this is the America you would discover. The population of the United States was approximately 50.2 million. Texas was 1.2 million, Montana 40,000, and Oregon 175,000. The president was Chester A. Arthur, Republican. There were 38 states, 10 territories, and one military district, Alaska. Hawaii was not annexed as a territory until 1898. The 1880s was the last great decade of immigrant wagon trains on the overland trails. The U.S. had four transcontinental railways and over 100,000 miles of railroad tracks. In 1880, 6,679,900 immigrants lived in the U.S. 10 years later, it was 9,249,500. The three diseases that killed the most Americans were diseases of the nervous systems, tuberculosis, and pneumonia. Note, at this point in the article, there is an image of an old American map which has points on the map, which the following text will indicate. Back to main text. 1. Fort Worth Stockyards became a major cattle shipping point in the Lone Star State. Between 1880 and 1890, the cattle town, notoriously known for its Hell's Half Acre, went from 6,663 residents to 23,076. 2. Doan's Crossing was founded by Jonathan Doan in 1878. For the next decade, a majority of Texas ranchers shifted from the Chisholm to the Western Trail, which headed north from Bandera and the Hill Country to Doan's Crossing of the Red River. More than 7 million head of cattle crossed the Red at the river's ford, which was approximately 100 miles west of the Chisholm's Red River crossing. 3. Dodge City was transformed from a dusty outpost of buffalo hiders to the wickedest little city in America after Kansas lawmakers moved the quarantine line for the tick-carrying Texas cattle so far west that Texas cattlemen were forced in 1876 to shift their drives to the Western Trail to Dodge City. 4. Abilene became Kansas's first queen of the cowtowns when the first Texas herds arrived in 1867 at the frontier village on the Smoky Hill River. 4 years later, after more than 440,000 beeves were shipped out of the former stage stop, Texas drovers shifted their herds to new railheads in Newton, Ellsworth, and Wichita. 5. Fort Laramie on the Laramie River in east central Wyoming was still a key frontier army post and supply center for westbound and eastbound wagon trains, freighters, and travelers in the early 1880s. In 1890, the fort was closed and decommissioned. 6. South Pass remained the most important crossing of the Continental Divide of the Rocky Mountains in southwestern Wyoming for travelers on the Oregon Trail in 1883. 7. Miles City, strategically located in the late 1870s at the confluence of the Tongue and Yellowstone Rivers, was a frontier outpost for soldiers and traders and became a key Northern Pacific railhead in 1881-82 for Texas cattlemen who drove their herds over 1,500 miles up the Western Trail to Montana's rich open-range grasslands. 8. Bozeman was incorporated in 1883, nearly two decades after John M. Bozeman founded it as the terminus of his self-named offshoot of the Oregon Trail west of Fort Laramie to Virginia City and the gold fields of Montana. 9. Salt Lake City was the capital of the Utah Territory and a key crossroads and supply center for Nevada, California, and Oregon-bound immigrants since the Salt Lake Cutoff was created in 1850. 10. Willamette Valley in western Oregon had been the primary destination for Oregon Trail immigrant settlers since 1841. The End of an Era by Johnny D. Boggs. Texans drove their last great herds north in the 1880s. Kansans had been complaining about Texas longhorns since the first herds hit Abilene in 1867, but the trail driving heyday kept booming, peaking in the 1880s. Almost 350,000 Texas cattle reached Kansas in 1880. Sure, Kansas established quarantine laws to prevent the spread of a tick-spread disease from coming up the Chisholm Trail. But there was still a market in Dodge City, 1875 to 85, and Caldwell, 1880 to 85. Texas cowboys would follow the Chisholm Trail into present-day Oklahoma, then Indian Territory, and take the Dodge City Cutoff to the Western Trail, also known as the Old Fort Griffin and Fort Dodge Trail. As quarantine lines moved west, cattlemen recommended sticking to the Western Trail completely. But ranches in Colorado, Wyoming, Montana, and Dakota Territory also needed beef to feed a growing population and to stock ranches. Texans herded cattle into Nebraska, Dakota Territory, Colorado, Wyoming, and Montana. Sure, railroads were crisscrossing much of the West by the 1880s, but Texas ranchers understood that outfitting a trail drive, say a cook, horse wrangler, a trail boss, and 10 to 12 cowboys, came a lot cheaper than paying the shipping prices railroads charged. By 1882, packing houses were paying more than $7 per hundredweight for cattle, up more than $3 from 1880. The cattle business became a gold brick, Wyoming cattleman John Clay recalled. Foreign investors, mostly from Great Britain, began pumping money into American livestock companies. But things were changing. In late November 1883, the Cherokee Strip Livestock Association in Indian Territory posted notice to drovers of Texas and Arkansas cattle that a trail used in the summers of the years 1881 and 1882 by what are known as through cattle drovers has been fenced by the members of this association and is included in pastures now stocked with domestic cattle, which renders it extremely dangerous to have this trail used by through Texas cattle. In 1885, the Texas legislature made the entire state off limits to Texas cattle. That didn't stop cattle from reaching Colorado, Wyoming, and Montana. The Goodnight Loving Trail, called the Goodnight Trail in the 1880s, was becoming popular for shipping cattle through West Texas and New Mexico territory. But in 1886, even the Northern New Mexico Association was fed up with Texas cattle eating New Mexico grass on the way north. Besides, New Mexicans had never cared much for the Lone Star State anyway, after Texas launched invasions in 1841 and 1862. By the mid-1880s, Texas cattlemen lobbied for a national cattle trail, effectively a permanent outlet to the Northwest, according to the Texas Livestock Journal. A proposed trail, 6 miles wide, 1,500 miles long, did not please many non-cattlemen. They talk and talk and talk, a correspondent covering a cattleman's gathering in St. Louis complained in the New York Sun in 1885, and get reporters to interview them so that they can bore the public with their narrow views about the disposition that should be made of the public domain, as though it were of the slightest importance what a few hundred men, many of them not citizen, who have unlawfully seized public lands, think should be done with the domain. Talks continued, however, and in March 1886, the Secretary of the Interior designated a strip 2 miles wide along the eastern Colorado border for the trail, but that was rescinded in June 1887. What caused the sudden turnaround? Mother Nature pretty much ended any further discussion. Cattle prices dropped in 1885. Then a severe drought struck in the spring and summer of 1886. The hard winter that followed in 1886-87 became known as the Big Die-Up. Some 25% of cattle on Colorado's Front Range perished. Montana estimated cattle losses at 362,000, more than half in the territory. Wyoming lost an estimated 15% of its herds, roughly 225,000 cattle. In 1887, the Denver Republican reported that 70,000 cattle left Texas that year but had been turned back because there was no market. The National Cattle Trail is abandoned, the newspaper reported. Never again in the history of the United States will great herds of Texas cattle be driven northward through Colorado to Wyoming and Montana. A national cattle trail might have been established years ago, a Pennsylvania cattleman told the New York Tribune early in 1887, but was neglected until the country got too thickly settled. Railroads had lowered shipping rates, the open range era of the cattle industry was ending, and the Great Trail Drives became part of Western history. John D. Boggs survived working on cattle drives in Arizona and New Mexico. Mother of Exiles by Candy Moulton. Immigration to the West in 1883 transformed the country. When 1883 writer Taylor Sheridan put a group of German immigrants on a wagon train heading toward Oregon, he drew from the historical record of immigration to America. During the 1880s, around 1.5 million Germans came to the United States, and the largest number of them arrived in 1882, when about 250,000 left their homeland for a new opportunity. Oregon saw the arrival of the first Volga Germans in 1881, people who had first settled on the Great Plains in central Kansas. Those German migrants left Kansas and found their way to California, where they boarded a steamship to travel from San Francisco to Portland. The following year, most of them left the Portland area and traveled to eastern Washington in search of an area where farmland was more plentiful. Some remained in Oregon, founding the village of Blooming. Germans traveled overland from Nebraska to Pendleton, Oregon area in 1882, and while some remained in the Pendleton area, several families kept traveling west to Portland and a new town they established in Albania. A decade later, more Germans migrated from the Midwest and Great Plains, settling the town of Canby, Oregon. Immigration by Eastern Europeans to America was not a new phenomenon. Indeed, Germans had been coming to America since the 1600s, with larger numbers arriving in the 1700s as they settled in Pennsylvania and other eastern areas. While living in Pennsylvania, German craftsmen built their first Conestoga wagons. Although these large wagons were never popular with overland travelers due to their massive size, they did see widespread use hauling freight, particularly along the Santa Fe Trail after its establishment in 1821. One of the better-known Germans who had influence in the American West was John Jacob Astor, who came from his village in Waldorf in 1784 and made a reputation and a fortune in the American fur trade. His name remains attached to the area since Astoria, Oregon was named for him. The first colony of Germans to settle in Texas arrived in 1844 and formed the community of New Braunfels. During the 1850s, the first period of peak immigration from Germany to America, nearly 1 million immigrants made the journey and settled in locations from Pennsylvania to Texas to the Dakotas, Nebraska, Missouri, and Colorado. Like other European immigrants, the Germans and Russian Germans left their homeland to start over in America in search of a better opportunity, religious freedom, and to escape political insecurity in their home countries. They brought with them a strong work ethic, the desire to live close to people from their homeland, and foods and beliefs unique to their culture. One other item they brought, hidden in their imported bags of winter wheat, was a weed that became ubiquitous to the Great Plains and a symbol of the West made popular in later-day films and music. Russian thistle, which we all recognize as tumbling tumbleweeds. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints began sending missionaries to Europe in the late 1830s and during the subsequent two decades encouraged and aided converts to the religion to relocate to the church headquarters in Salt Lake City, eventually spreading throughout Utah and the surrounding states. This immigration was heaviest in the 1850s, with thousands traveling by ship, train, and wagon train from 1850 to 1856. That year, the LDS Church launched a new migration method when it began using hand carts for the travelers who literally pushed and pulled their belongings across the plains using small two-wheeled carts that were human-powered. In all, around 3,000 Mormon converts from England, Scotland, Ireland, and the Scandinavian countries traveled using hand carts. Swedes began immigrating in the 1860s, with most of them settling in Illinois before they moved west into the Dakotas and Nebraska. They spread south across Kansas and into Texas, and also pushed farther west, finding that their woodworking skills were a great advantage as they built and worked in tie camps throughout Wyoming after the 1870s and well into the final years of the 19th century. While some Swedish settlements, particularly in Kansas and Texas, were organized and involved numerous families, the Swedish and Norwegian settlement of the Dakotas was more individualized. Even so, hundreds of Scandinavians found land, built new homes, and established themselves in the West, particularly in the period after the 1880s, when the Indian tribes of the region they settled had been forced onto reservations. Many other nationalities came to the West during the period of 1883 and later, arriving from Ireland, Italy, Belgium, Scotland, and the Bohemian region, and other countries. All had a similar goal, a better life for themselves and their families. Immigration to the United States in the 1880s. In 1880, 6,679,942 immigrants arrived in the U.S., 5,751,823 from Europe, 107,630 from Asia, 717,285 from Northern America, including Canada, 90,073 from Latin America, including Mexico, 6,859 from Oceania, 2,204 from Africa. In 1882, 250,000 Germans arrived in the U.S., with over 1.5 million arriving between 1880 to 1890. The mass migration of Jews from Russia, Austria-Hungary, and Romania to the U.S. began in 1880. Entrance into the U.S. was regulated by the Passenger Act of 1882, also known as the Chinese Exclusion Act, the first American law to forbid one specific nationality from legally immigrating into the United States. Candy Moulton is the author of The Mormon Handcart Migration, Tung Nor Pin Can Never Tell the Story, and Roadside History of Nebraska. Her own family immigrated from Belgium, but not until the early years of the 20th century. Big Jim Courtwright by Eric J. Wright. Fort Worth's marshal was as notorious as the Hell's Half Acre he ruled. Billy Bob Thornton's portrayal of Fort Worth Marshal Big Jim Courtwright in the hit series 1883 makes for great television, but it is not how things really were. In the show, Courtwright polices the bawdy and dangerous red light district known as Hell's Half Acre, which was a real place. But even the most violent mining camps in Nevada, some of the toughest to have ever existed, were not as bad as this. However, this is television, and media like this is meant to inspire further interest in the history behind the stories they portray. So, who was Jim Courtwright? Courtwright was a native of Illinois who fought for the Union during the Civil War. While little is known about his early years, by the time he ended up in Fort Worth, he was known to be working both sides of the law. Certainly, Courtwright was a tough individual. He was a known gambler and gunman with a fearsome reputation, but not the type to walk into a saloon and kill five cowboys in a matter of seconds. Courtwright was shrewd enough to understand that the cowboys were good for the local economy, even if the Acre, as it became known, was gaining a disreputable image across the state of Texas. In 1883, the Austin Weekly Statesman called the acre the Five Points of Fort Worth, while the following year, the Laredo Times noted, in Hell's Half Acre, the devil would find his own and be at home there. Quick to defend its home turf, the Fort Worth Daily Gazette responded to like allegations in 1990. There is no Hell's Half Acre here. Fort Worth has no more bad people in proportion than you would find in any prosperous city. Still, men like Courtright did nothing to enhance the Acre's reputation. Known for operating a protection racket for local businesses, including saloons, brothels, and gambling dens, Courtright ran afoul of Kansas gunman and gambler Luke Short. Known widely for his killing of Pacific Slope gambler Charlie Storms in Tombstone in 1881, Short had fallen back to Dodge City before coming to Fort Worth. By 1887, Short was operating the upstairs gambling concessions in the White Elephant Saloon, which sat several blocks north of the Acre and thus attracted a more respectable clientele. Unpopular with both city officials for his promotion of keno games and down-on-their-luck gamblers like Courtright, Short, known locally as the King Gambler of Fort Worth, was an easy target. Numerous theories exist as to why the two men clashed, but the likely scenario involves Courtright approaching Short for a cut of the action, thus infuriating Short. Whatever the reason, during a heated conversation between the two on the sidewalk just north of the White Elephant on the night of February 8, 1887, both men drew iron, and Courtright dropped dead with three bullets from Short's gun. After the death of Courtright, many of his friends and associates sought revenge, but an effort to lynch Short was foiled. Legal charges against him were ultimately dropped, likely in support of self-defense, as it was widely reported that Courtright drew first. Law and Order on the Overland Trails by Eric J. Wright. Each traveler was a marching ordnance department. Over the span of about 30 years, an estimated 300,000 immigrants traveled the overland trails to points west in places like California, Oregon, and Utah. Many of these intrepid travelers were inexperienced farming families from the east, or individuals from overseas with no practical experience with the kinds of dangers that could befall them on the journey ahead. Disease, accidents, Indian depredations, and harsh environmental conditions all played into the dangers of manifest destiny. The journals and letters of overland trail immigrants often begin with idyllic and optimistic tone, but that quickly sours once the traveling became arduous as they neared the Rocky Mountains. Adding to the danger was the probability that most of the immigrants had no experience with firearms outside of hunting. As a reaction to the dangers that lay ahead, immigrants often armed themselves heavily. One contemporary noted the immigrants' fixation with firearms, while George Gibbs, writing from Fort Kearney in Nebraska, observed that each traveler was a marching ordnance department. The Missouri Republican printed a letter on June 16, 1869, from someone known simply as Pawnee, and in it the writer said, "Arms of all kinds must certainly be scarce in the States after such a drain as the immigrants must have made upon them. Not a man, but what has a gun or revolver or two, and one fellow I saw actually had no less than three bowie knives stuck in his belt." Most of these immigrants traveled in large wagon trains that set out from places like Westport, Missouri. This assured some level of protection, but it was not a guarantee. Official promoters of law and order were only available at the sporadic forts along the trails. Otherwise, the immigrants were on their own. Therefore, a captain was selected by popular vote to lead the wagon train, like a captain of a ship would oversee his sailors. Overlander Oliver Goldsmith reported some years later, "Indeed, we were prepared for almost any emergency. In our company, wagon trains, were a blacksmith, several carpenters, wagon makers, millwrights, mechanics of all kinds, and men of all professions." Despite the usefulness of Goldsmith's wagon train, some, however, were not so lucky. Early in the Overland Trail experience, outlaws saw the mass migration as a prime opportunity for exploitation. Pioneer Lauren Brown Hastings later wrote, "I look back upon the long, dangerous, and precarious immigrant road with a degree of romance and pleasure, but to others, it is the graveyard of their friends." To combat these fears of impending violence, the wagon trains often established an ad hoc legal system. Trial by jury for guilty offenders for offenses like theft, assault, and other smaller crimes were dealt with swiftly. Severe crimes like rape and murder were given harsh punishments, which were often in the form of banishment from the wagon train. One such example was recalled by Goldsmith, who, after a hailstorm on the plains, encountered a lone Irishman approaching his wagon train with nothing but a tea kettle on his head to protect him from the elements. Sometimes, however, those overseeing the judicial proceedings opted for execution. In June 1852, a young man named Lafayette Tate stabbed another member of his party in the back. While the trial was underway, Tate protested and requested to be taken back to civilization to stand trial. However, one member of the wagon train recalled, "He had committed murder on the plains. He should be tried on the plains, and if found guilty, should be hung on the plains." Eric J. Wright is an associate editor of True West and the assistant editor of the Tombstone Epitaph. The Pinkertons Find Their Way West by Mark Boardman. After 1865, the Midwest Detective Agency became respected and feared across the frontier. The Pinkerton Detective Agency was bound to join the movement to the West. Like so many, it followed the rails. Upon founding the organization in 1855, Alan Pinkerton signed contracts with a number of small eastern railroads. The original task: prevent employee theft of company property, as well as goods slated for shipment. The Pinkertons' success was noted by other railroad companies in the Midwest. After its Civil War work protecting President Abraham Lincoln and spying for the Union, the agency turned its focus back to the railroads, but it faced a new challenge. In 1866, Indiana's Reno Gang started holding up trains, seeking riches from the Adams Express shipments. Adams and the railroads failed to stop the robbers, so they called in the Pinkertons. That the agency was based in nearby Chicago expedited the hire. The Pinkertons, working with local law enforcement and often relying on dubious methods, helped break the Renos. Alan Pinkerton took all the credit and spearheaded a national publicity campaign. Railroads farther west took notice. So did state and local governments, which hired the agency to take on outlaw outfits in their areas. The Pinkertons battled the James Younger Gang and the Wild Bunch, among other gangs. The agency's reputation grew as it moved to the West Coast. There were failures, such as the 1874 bombing of a Missouri house that killed the half-brother and maimed the mother of Frank and Jesse James. But the bad publicity did little to shake the confidence that the railroad barons and government officials had in the Pinkertons, and the company's public relations machine cranked out the exaggerated narrative that they were the top crime fighters in the U.S. Other industries decided to follow suit. Mining companies wanted greater control over their workers, so they brought in the Pinkertons to fight unions. In the early 1870s, detectives helped crush the Molly Maguires, a violent Irish immigrant group that disrupted operations in the Pennsylvania coal fields. And as mining developed out west, companies hired the Pinkertons for similar jobs. By the 1890s, the Pinkertons had moved into violent strike breaking, effectively creating and enforcing their own laws. Many rank and file Americans began considering Pinkerton another word for thug. But the agency benefactors, especially railroad and mining interests, continued using its detectives well into the 20th century. The Pinkerton Detective Agency covered the nation by following the rails. Indians and Wagon Trains by Mark Boardman. Hollywood exaggerates the danger faced by travelers. The scene is a familiar one in the Westerns. A wagon train bringing Easterners to a land of hope and opportunity is attacked by Indians. Sometimes the train is strung out in a long line along the well-traveled trail. In others, the voyagers have settled in for the night when natives rush the group, seeking to kill the whites and steal their horses and other animals, as well as various and sundry items. If one accepted that as gospel, it appears that every caravan was subject to attack. Well, that's Hollywood's take, but it's an exaggeration. Yes, there were Indian attacks on wagon trains, but nobody knows how many such fights there were between the 1820s and 1880. For several reasons, it's likely they were very rare occurrences. First, the travelers were generally well-armed and prepared to fight as needed. They viewed Indians with suspicion and were normally on their guard. At night, most did circle the wagons to form an impressive fortress and to keep animals penned inside. Indians were reticent to charge such a barrier, knowing that they would take heavy casualties, even if they eventually won the battle. And as more forts were constructed on the trails, Indian bands faced the possibility that soldiers were nearby and could intercede in any attack. There were exceptions. Sometimes a wagon train would get strung out on the trail, with some wagons lagging far behind. Indians could pick the stragglers off before the other travelers could mobilize a defense. After that, the survivors were much more cautious. Or the Indians used subterfuge to gain an advantage. In July 1864, a small wagon train, five wagons with 11 people, was on the Oregon Trail, about 120 miles northwest of Fort Laramie, Wyoming Territory. A group mainly of Oglala Sioux Indians approached the group, signaling peaceful intentions. They asked for sugar, tobacco, and bread, which they were given. The Indians joined the train as it continued its journey. More Indians, perhaps totaling 100 warriors, also joined. The travelers stopped to camp for the night, unhitching horses and shifting possessions. While their attention wandered, the Indians attacked. Three members of the train were killed and several others wounded. A number of women were captured and taken away, although most escaped within a few days. Other wagon trains following the trail learned from that incident and were on guard. Most of them never saw Indians. But that's not the Hollywood version. Mark Boardman is features editor of True West and editor of the Tombstone Epitaph. He is also a pastor in Indiana. Blood Brothers by Stuart Rosebrook. 1883 recreates a unique moment in the Civil War. In 1883's Episode 2, Taylor Sheridan recreates an actual moment from the Civil War with Tom Hanks as Union Major General George Meade and Tim McGraw as Confederate Captain James Dutton. In the fictional flashback scene to the Battle of antonym of September 17th, 1862, a Confederate officer, McGraw, staggers to his feet and wanders among the dead bodies. Many posed faithfully from Matthew Brady photographs. Then we see General Meade, Hanks, sit down next to the Confederate captain, and they commiserate. In reality, Second Lieutenant George Armstrong Custer was photographed visiting with his captured West Point classmate, Confederate Lieutenant James B. Washington, on May 6, 1862, several days after the Battle of Williamsburg. In the immediate aftermath of the bloody fight, Custer walked amid the dead and dying and found another fellow West Pointer, 5th North Carolina Infantry Captain John Gimlet W. Lee, then carried him to a Union Field hospital. Lee survived, and 2 months later, Custer stood up with his captured, recuperating friend in his wedding to Margaret Durfee. Swearing in Westerns by Bob Bowes Bell. Is the cursing on the streaming series 1883 accurate? I think it's safe to say most of us are more profane than our parents, or certainly earlier generations. I know I swear quite freely in conversation with friends and at work, especially at work, and for some reason when I am talking out loud to myself. When I am on my daily walks, I talk a blue streak, usually about some dumb thing I did or said. Sometimes my dog, Uno, looks up at me like, "Are you all right?" Some might see this as liberating and make the argument that today we are freer to express ourselves without judgment or the silly rules of polite society. I half buy that, except for when I was with my kids, ages 6 and 9, on a Salt River tubing bus, and some teenagers in front of the bus were loudly cussing up a storm, with the centerpiece being the F-bomb in all its ridiculous permeations. The bus driver finally told them to pipe down, but of course, that made them even louder and more profane. At that point, I didn't see it as liberating, just coarse and inappropriate. Which brings us back to the swearing in 1883. I've posted several takes on this cussing phenom down through the history and in Westerns of late, and the response has been astounding, with over 180,000 views and over 700 comments. Let's see if I can distill down what I heard you say and what I believe to be true. The use of the F-bomb in a Western is off-putting because it sounds too modern and coarse for a cowboy to be using. Some linguists have postulated that the overuse of the F-bomb as a verb, adjective, and everything in between is a byproduct of World War II, when the greatest generation needed extra octane when it came to describing and surviving savage war conditions. Consider the acronym FUBAR from 1944. If true, and I tend to buy it, then the usage of the word in a Western is not authentic to Old West times. Here's a good rule of thumb. If you hear a cowboy use the word ma'am in a sentence, he will not say swear words of any kind in front of women and children. He just won't. It is not condoned in his culture, past and present. And it is not condoned, and it will not be tolerated even by the roughest of the breed. Especially by the roughest. Yes, he will swear on the range with other men, perhaps even using the F-bomb. But if a woman shows up, he will clip his lip pronto. This is true today, but it was even more true back then. True West Magazine, February-March 2022. Chili Queens by Sherry Monahan. For two centuries, locals and visitors to public plazas of San Antonio, Texas, dined on the famous fiery cuisine. San Antonio, Texas became famous for its Chili Queens in the late 1800s and early 20th century. But historians believe the renowned local cuisine was prepared and sold publicly in the Mission City as early as 200 years ago. Over time, the locations changed, but in the mid to late 1800s, Chili Con Carne stands at Military Plaza offered Mexican specialties. Spicy aromas scented the air. Women called from their carts in Spanish and English to attract customers, and music filled the plaza. In this wondrous culinary scene, people dined on tamales, enchiladas, eggs, beans, and chili con carne. While other Texas cities had chili con carne stands, none were like San Antonio's. Journalists informed their readers that no trip to San Antonio would be complete without a stop at one of the Chili Queen stands. While the term Chili Queen conjured up tasty thoughts of visiting San Antonio, the term was also applied to fallen women of Hispanic descent. Fort Worth had its own Chili Queen named Susie Barton, who worked in Hell's Half Acre. Although Susie might have been spicy, it wasn't because she sold chilies, if you know what I mean. There were three classes of queens, according to the San Antonio Light in 1892. The first type acted out of necessity, was from the countryside, and probably had run away from home and needed work. Next was the Mexican señorita, whose parents likely owned the stand and were nearing retirement. Lastly, there was the true queen, who was raised in the art of deception and was generally known to be fly or flippant. The true queen was between 16 and 20 years old, usually good-looking, nicely dressed and polite. The girls worked from 8 p.m. and remained at their stands until the wee hours of the morning. They earned a dollar or a dollar 50 per day, and the most educated in their business made $20 to $35 per week, according to the article. Sadie Thornhill Rosenbaum was well known as the Queen of Queens because of her cooking talent, beauty, and vivaciousness. Before her Chili Queen reign, she appeared on the stage. In 1895, Forest and Stream recalled dinner at Sadie's during her tenure. If Sadie be not one of the features of interest of San Antonio and one of the leading citizens of town, to what or to whom shall we ascribe that honor? Of course, a chili supper at Sadie's Casa was to be the close of ceremonies in San Antonio. Sadie was going to give us this supper herself, but we couldn't allow that. Sadie was still doing business at the old stand, and so was her Mexican cook, Pancho. "Pancho is so funny when he's drunk," said Sadie, philosophically. The story went on to note that when Pancho wasn't under the weather from aguardiente, also known as liquor, he cooked the best eggs, chili con carne, and other delights. When the men from Forest and Stream departed from Sadie's stand, she bid them adios and pinned a fresh flower to a buttonhole on each of their suits. They concluded, "Sadie is not to be misunderstood. She is simply unique, the last type of vanishing class which has no precedence, which summons no comparison and needs no comment. After this, where else in all the world shall one buy his chili supper?" Sadie was the charming hostess of the chili stand, and they considered her the last in a long dynasty of chili queens. No other stand compared to hers. But alas, Marriage interrupted the celebration of taste buds from her stand. In 1892, Mrs. Sadie M. Thornhill was the last queen at 304 Alamo Plaza. And in 1894, she married Frank Swallis, and her reign ended. Sadly, so did her marriage when Frank abandoned her in 1897, and she went back to calling herself Thornhill, which is how old-timers recalled her in their stories. Marta Garcia, another early queen, was a tall, slender, black-eyed senorita who was second only to Sadie. Other queens included Rosa, Ella, and Jovita, who served many customers on the plazas. Jovita was remembered for her small stature and quaint calls of un medio tamales y chile gravy, un plata chile con carne y frijoles. She also called dame dos blanquillos y chile gravy y metrias dos tortillas tostada. A plate of chili con carne with beans or eggs with chili sauce and toasted tortillas. Other women included Mrs. Rosaria España and Teresa González. On a June evening in 1986, Marta and Teresa were arrested for fighting and abusive language, but the recorder later dismissed the case. Not all the queens were of Mexican descent. Others included Agnes Pearson, sisters Rose and Lulu Davis, and Jenny Johnson. Some of these queens were also employed at the Variety Theater, where they got a little disorderly at times. Jenny was 17 years old and was often in the company of another teen named Lily Atkinson. In 1892, the two were living on Concho Street with Lulu Davis and likely Rose Davis. Lily and Lulu were arrested in September that year for being drunk and disorderly. It was soon learned neither had parents and that they had grown up on the streets. The city was perplexed as to what to do with them. The following year, Lily and Jenny gave up their chili business and began running the streets at night. Seen drinking beer and being raucous, they were arrested as vagrants. Because of the unsanitary conditions at some of the chili stands, the city opened and closed them over the years. In April 1896, the San Antonio Express grew frustrated over the closing of the chili stands and urged the city council to allow the reestablishment of them. They suggested to the council that they require a license for all stands with a nominal fee so they could be regulated. If a stand was found to be unsanitary or disorderly, then the city could revoke their license. The newspaper reported the most potent step in connection with the first requirement would be the dethronement of the Chili Queens. The following year, the talented senoritas were back, and that same newspaper ran a glorious story about them. It reported that tourists, after seeing the Alamo, must partake of a Mexican supper served by the Chili Queens. It reported, this was in the late 80s, the palmy days of the Chili Queens, when their fame had spread. They were idealized as stunning creatures with rich brown skins of the tropics and languorous grace and bewitching black eyes of Spanish donnas. According to the story, there were six senoritas, and one called to her server, Jesus, andale, dos platas de chile con carne y dos tamales con chile gravy y de enchiladas tortillas y dos tazas de café. She called for two plates of chile con carne, two tamales with gravy, enchiladas, and two cups of coffee. The article continued, the fiercely burning chile con carne agonizes the tourist who manages to struggle through the tamales by drinking a great deal of water. The article went on to say that by the 1890s, the fame of the original queens faded as they were forced to leave the backdrop of the Alamo. They continued on, but it was never quite the same without the majestic background. Author William Brann, who lived in Texas, wrote about the Chili Queens in 1898. He stated, We must have several days and nights for sightseeing in San Antonio. We must dream about the ruined missions where, before our grandsire's day, the savage was taught to humble himself before the sacred cross. About the Alamo, that charnel house of chivalry, we will be shown a dozen different places where Bowie bled and Crockett died. But no matter, it's all holy ground. We must have a Mexican supper in the open air and a talk with the chili queens. We must have hot tamales with ice-cold beer on the side to temper the internal fires. Listen to the music in Alamo Plaza and witness the Battle of Flowers. The Daily Express wrote, "Nearly all of the queens and vendors of the hot stuff will move. Although the chili stands have been moved from their plazas in the past 10 years, they have lost none of their attractiveness, and the quality of the tamales and other edibles remains as good as in the past. The chili queens remained on the military plaza, but moved to various locations through the years as the city progressed. Later, the chili stands lined Pasquale Square, but in January 1900, they had to move to make way for progress. Nearly all of them moved to East Street, between Commerce and Buena Vista. It was also around this time that the word chili, C-H-I-L-E, was changed to chili, C-H-I-L-I. The stands were closed again, but in 1904, the San Antonio Women's Club introduced their chili queens back to the plazas after they were closed again for health reasons. Each Wednesday evening, the women offered chili, tamales, and tortillas served under the old torchlights under the stars. The chili queens appeared again in 1916 on Alamo Plaza, and the newspaper noted, "Beginning this week, she will serve chili and frijoles in the good old way from opened-air stands." This practice, having been discontinued because of demands for sanitation and progress, will be restored by the Women's Club. In 1925, the Chili Queens appeared again, but this time on Haymarket Plaza, and offered a nightly rendezvous of chili victuals al fresco that included tamales and enchiladas. While the true glory days of the Queens happened in the 1800s, the Queens and their stands lasted until the 1930s. In 1938, a headline in the San Antonio Light read, "S.A. Plaza Chili Queens Still Reign." The article noted that while the queens remained, their domains were greatly reduced, and they were now also called baratillos, which were individual kitchens housed in a large building and each offering their own fare. By 1939, San Antonio's mayor wanted to bring back the days of old with open-air chili stands. In 1940, the San Antonio Light wrote, "Alfred Rodriguez is said to be infusing the forlorn Chili Queen crowds with the same hoopla that characterized their opening season last summer. His simple trick is to mask the troubadours and have jam sessions with Mexican canciones." Seeing the need, Mayor Maury Maverick said, "If we can get the Chili Queens back on the plaza, it will revive one of San Antonio's most romantic and colorful mementos of the past." A committee was formed, and some chili stands appeared on Haymarket Plaza, but they were short-lived, and by 1941, they faced the same sanitation issue as in the past, and that was the last revival of the Queens. Chile, C-H-I-L-E, versus chili, C-H-I-L-I. The word chile refers to the pepper itself when it's spelled with an E at the end. If it's spelled chili with an I at the end, it refers to the dish of meat and chili peppers. The spelling differences also spilled over when it came to the chili queens. In the 1800s, the spelling was tied to the actual chili itself. It later changed to reflect the dish, chili. Add to that simple misspellings, and the word is interchanged during the 1800s and 1900s. By 1904, the word chili, C-H-I-L-I, began replacing Chile when referring to the queens. Today, both words are used to describe these colorful women of San Antonio's past. Sherry Monahan has been researching and sharing the culinary history of the American West for over 20 years. She feels that the food and beverages people enjoyed and survived on tell a great deal about the people. Regional dishes emerged, classics were reinvented, and native dishes were introduced to pioneers. New Mexico Chilies, True West Magazine, February-March 2022 edition, by Sherry Monahan. Ever since Don Juan Oñate brought the fiery fruit to Nuevo Mexico in 1598, the chili pepper has defined cuisine in the land of enchantment. New Mexico's food history is heavily influenced by its people, including the Hopis and other native tribes, as well as the Mexican people. Red and later green chilies played a large role in the local cuisine. Dishes like green chili stew, chili con carne, chili rellenos, and pozole are some of the most popular dishes enjoyed then and now. In 1874, the Las Vegas Gazette listed New Mexico's natural agricultural resources, which included grapes, corn, barley, beans, pinon nuts, onions, and chilies. The article noted that the chili, or pod pepper, was of excellent quality and was grown all over the state. It is said to excel in quality that raised anywhere in the states on account of its mild nature and is extensively used in cookery as a standard dish. Newspapers like the Albuquerque Morning Democrat listed a weekly market review to allow its readers to see what was available. An 1895 list included butter, cream cheese, eggs, olives, lemons, ground red chili pepper, and whole ground red chili pepper. Green chilies also were sold at the local markets in the late 1800s. They were so prolific on Theodore Roault's Las Cruces garden that he canned some as an experiment. He processed them at Mesilla Valley Canning Factory, where he already was canning tomatoes. He stated that canning the peeled peppers preserved their flavor, and in 1898, he put up several hundred cases. They were a huge success, and he sold almost the entire lot, so he planned on canning over 4,000 cases in 1899. In 1905, when a rival Los Angeles cannery claimed it was the first to can Mexican peeled green chilies, Roault objected to the claim and stated that he was the first person to can them. Green chilies were used in a variety of dishes, but green chili con carne was a popular dish in the late 1800s. It was served at many restaurants, including the Bon Ton in Santa Fe. The restaurant received chilies from Blas Sandoval of Peña Blanca, who brought his wagons to town and sold them to the owners. The local paper noted, "If you want a genuine dish of green chili con carne, go to the Bon Ton restaurant, where they are the experts at the business." They also sold tamales, enchiladas, fresh mountain trout, chicken, pozole, chili verde, menudo, chicharrones, and any other Mexican or Spanish dish ever heard of. As the turn of the century neared, Mesilla Valley had grown into a chili-producing area where peppers were raised and canned. The local paper noted the peppers were always in demand, and the canning was very profitable. It reported, "Last year we imported large quantities of the large Mexican peppers in cans, which are quite spicy." One man, whose last name was Barnes, shared his thoughts on chilies, but not about their spice. While spending some time in the Socorro jail, Mr. Barnes claimed the chilies caused his consumption disease. The local paper noted in jest, "Let some able chemist analyze red pepper at once." Chilies are also used in chili rellenos and huevos rancheros. This is an old recipe from La Fonda in Santa Fe. Chiles rellenos a la Conrad. 8 roasted green chili peppers. 1 egg beaten. 1/2 cup grated aged Monterey Jack cheese. Butter. 1/2 cup flour. Place roasted peppers in a bowl and cover with plastic wrap. Let them sit until soft. When cool enough to handle, remove the skins. Make a slit in one side from top to bottom and remove the seeds. Fill each chili pepper with 1 tablespoon grated cheese. Roll in flour. Dip in beaten egg. Roll again in flour. Brown in butter. Adapted from Chef Conrad Alleguer's recipe, which appeared in the Super Chief Cookbook of Famous Fred Harvey Recipes, 1948.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.